It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, we track the latest in national politics, including two more additions to the Republican presidential field.
First, new national job numbers are out today, and they're taking on extra significance as they could provide the clearest picture of job creation for the 4 years of Scott Walker's first term as governor of Wisconsin.
In those 4 years, from 2011 to 2014, Wisconsin created jobs at a rate of 5.7%. That puts the state at 35th in the nation for private sector job creation, a figure that promises to be fairly significant going forward, both in the state legislature and on the national scene, as all signs point to a Walker presidential run.
Here with us now to break down the numbers is Craig Gilbert. He's the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief and writes the Wisconsin Voter blog about politics and elections. Craig, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, this report is being framed as the most accurate and definitive of labor figures available. What makes these numbers better than other job numbers we've seen?
Well, these numbers are essentially a count, whereas other sources of data on unemployment and job growth are based on surveys, sort of like opinion polls. And so because they're based on a sample, they have a margin of error. This is really a full count. That's why it's called a census. And, you know, the only downside is because it's more comprehensive, there's a six-month lag time, and so the numbers generally don't get as much attention because by the time they come out, people feel like they're a little bit out of date. But in this case, it closes the books, really, on Governor Walker's first term, and it also gives us something we didn't have before, which is a sense of where the state during those 4 years ranked compared to other states and compared to the nation as a whole.
So given that it appears to be this very clear picture, given that it's a count and not a survey, what does this say about how important these numbers are for Governor Scott Walker?
Well, you know, numbers, they have kind of a cold, hard reality to them. A lot of people say a lot of things. There's a lot of spin that goes on when it comes to different kinds of metrics like jobs numbers. There's been sort of a running saga over job trends and job performance in Wisconsin throughout Governor Walker's term, starting with actually his first election campaign when he made the jobs promise of 250,000 private sector jobs in his first 4 years, and then through the recall and his reelection campaign. And so they're out there, they're in black and white. They don't look particularly flattering for the state because we pretty consistently lag behind the rest of the country and the rest of the Midwest in private sector job growth. We've obviously fallen well short of the governor's 250,000 jobs pledge. So it's really kind of up to the governor now to kind of explain, I think, you know, why the state hasn't performed as well as he had hoped and had promised. And there's no getting around the fact that we have consistently lagged by this one indicator. Of course, it's not the only indicator out there, but it's a big one that I think resonates politically.
Well, let's get to the actual numbers. What do they say about how Wisconsin did?
Well, they say that, you know, when you look at the four-year period in its entirety, you know, we grew private sector jobs at a rate that was considerably slower than the country as a whole. We ranked 35 out of the 50 states in our four-year performance. And then if you look at the individual years, it's been pretty consistent. I mean, we've consistently grown private sector jobs at a rate of about between 1 and 1.5% a year, and we've consistently been, you know, between 35th and 40th among the states on a year-by-year basis. So I think these numbers kind of leave an even bigger imprint when you see how stable they've been. And then you sort of get to the discussion of why and how much the governor has to do with it, how much of these trends are just embedded in the structure of the state's economy, and that's a big debate.
Well, to look first at that 5.7% job growth rate and compare that against the campaign promise of 250,000 new jobs, what does that translate to in numbers?
So instead of 250,000 new private sector jobs, we ended up with about 129,000. So we got about halfway there. And so that, you know, some people, when the governor made, I think anybody who really followed the numbers closely, I think would have assumed when the governor made that promise that he wouldn't be able to live up to it because he was really projecting a rate of growth. It was really improbable based on the state's historic performance. But that was the number he threw out there. It was attention getting by design. It was a campaign. It was part of his campaign. He talked about it all the time. And he probably benefited politically from setting the bar there. But now he sort of has to live with the consequences, which are that he didn't really come close to getting there. And you know, it would probably take several more years to actually get to that target date at this point.
We're talking with Craig Gilbert, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief, also author of the Wisconsin Voter Blog, talking about the latest job numbers for Wisconsin between 2011 and 2014. And to get at that why question a little bit more, some economists have made the point that job creation isn't necessarily something that we can lay at the governor's door, for better or worse for him. It's maybe more a product of complex factors, a mix of things. What do you say to that, and how Walker might use these numbers?
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, let's face it. The state, you know, operates in a national economy. So the biggest driver of these numbers is probably the national economy. When it comes to the state-by-state differences, it's going to, you know, every state has a different employment base. In Wisconsin, we're more manufacturing heavy than other states in general. And some economists have pointed to kind of the traditional nature of our manufacturing economy as explaining, in part at least, our slow rate of growth. Those jobs have not been growing at a high rate across the country. So I think it's fair for the governor to talk about the larger context. On the other hand, he has also been running for re-election as a governor, and now probably as a candidate for president, making an argument about how he's turned the state around economically and characterizing the state as kind of a bright spot in the region and in the country. And so it makes it, I think, more difficult to kind of sell that message when your job performance by these measures is not only mediocre but below average.
How does Wisconsin compare to its Midwest neighbors, maybe other states that also have a heavy manufacturing base? Michigan comes to mind.
Yeah, so if you go by the four-year period, Michigan actually ranked, I believe, 10th out of the 50 states in the growth in private sector jobs over these 4 years. Indiana, I believe, was 18th. Indiana's also, I think, up with Wisconsin as the two most manufacturing-heavy states in the country. And then Iowa was in, you know, a little bit lower. Actually, Iowa and Illinois were in the 30s, but ahead of Wisconsin. Minnesota was in the 20s. And, you know, when you think about what's going on in some of these states, you've got Minnesota, which is at one neighbor, under a Democratic governor. There's been a lot of chatter about how these two states are performing based on very different governing models, considering which party controls each one. And Illinois has been kind of a rhetorical punching bag for the governor for a long time. And Wisconsin and Illinois are basically performing the same way. Wisconsin, by this measure, slightly worse. And so that's, I think, awkward, too, for the governor, because he's been using Illinois as kind of a foil politically about how they're running things and their tax policy and their economic policies. You know, none of this is to say that if the governor had been governing differently, these numbers would be dramatically different. We'll never know that, but it's harder to sell his story as kind of a turnaround artist when the numbers are kind of underwhelming.
Now, Governor Walker is in Canada right now, but has he had anything to say about this new report?
I haven't talked to him, and I'm sure his office will have something to say about it, because they've been pretty aggressive about, I think, their message on jobs. And, you know, they point to the state's unemployment rate, which has gotten considerably lower and is better than average or lower than average. Again, this jobs number isn't the only metric, but it's a measure that the governor himself has placed a lot of emphasis on going back to his very first campaign.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
That was Craig Gilbert, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief, also author of the Wisconsin Voter Blog. He joined us to talk about the latest job numbers and what they could mean for Governor Walker going forward. we head to Washington for our weekly look at the latest in national politics. Two more Republican contenders have entered the primary race this week. One, Jeb Bush, considered a front runner. The other, Donald Trump, seen as a wild card in the race.
Congress has a lot on its plate. Meanwhile, Democrats backing a new trade agreement are trying to pick up the pieces after fast-track legislation failed last week. And Republicans are meeting today to talk about what they'll do if the U.S. Supreme Court rules against many of the subsidies provided under Obamacare. Here with us now is Ken Vogel, Chief Investigative Correspondent at Politico. Ken, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be with you guys.
Well, let's start with the presidential race. Jeb Bush announcing his candidacy in Miami on Monday. He had a slow start in his pre-campaign, which I guess is a thing that we have now. What does Jeb Bush need to do at this point to make up the ground he lost before he announced?
Well, it's never going to be as easy as some believe for Jeb Bush. Sure, he has the name. He has the fundraising base. And he has sort of a moderate bearing about him that really made him a superstar with major donors and sort of GOP elites here in Washington, and sort of had them believing that he would have a cakewalk to the nomination. But those very things that they regarded as selling points are seen as sort of detriments among the many in the Republican base, where he is seen as too moderate, as too beholden to GOP business interests. And some of the stances that he's taken on hot-button issues like immigration reform, which he supports, the Common Core educational reform, which he also supports, are seen as anathema in the Republican base. So he's got to keep on with this very delicate balancing act of trying to appeal to folks in the Republican base with a message of experience and a track record of accomplishment in Florida, while simultaneously keeping the folks in the Republican Party elite and the donor class happy. That is not an easy line to walk. It tripped up Mitt Romney, who was very similarly positioned to Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush is trying to give it another go in a much more crowded field that potentially could play into his benefit.
Well, I was going to say, Mitt Romney, a lot of what you just said applied to him last time around. We saw through the campaign one candidate after another being the Romney alternative. Ultimately, the alternative was Mitt Romney. So is it different this time around? Do you think there are really more serious challengers to Jeb Bush than Mitt Romney faced?
There are definitely more serious challengers, folks who we, as odds makers, sort of assess as having the trappings of a more credible campaign structure and a more viable path to the nomination. But some of the same dynamics are still in play. That is, this need to balance the sometimes competing and contradicting imperatives of the GOP base and the GOP elites and donors. And Jeb Bush has some competition in that regard as well, in that there are a number of candidates who are vying for that same sort of establishment mantle that he is vying for and that Mitt Romney successfully assumed and eventually rode to the Republican nomination, although not before there was a very damaging and very drawn-out primary. That's what Jeb Bush is trying to avoid. I think he is regarded as less of a favorite than Mitt Romney was back in 2012, and that there are more viable competitors.
Now, people have been making a lot of the campaign signage here. The word Jeb featured very prominently. The word Bush, not so much. So is he trying to chart a separate course from his brother and his dad, both presidents?
Yeah, I mean, that's the blessing and the curse of being, an establishment candidate with not just a network of folks who had supported previous establishment successful candidates, those being his father and his brother, but he's even more linked to them, obviously, by virtue of his last name than, say, Mitt Romney, who was trying to tap into that same network. And while I think he's done a pretty good job, despite having already shaken up his campaign staff, with that balance and sort of walking that tightrope that we talked about, nonetheless, his one sort of major policy stumble that we've seen over Iraq and the Iraq War, and whether a question about whether he would have done things differently, which he seemed to suggest initially that he wouldn't, and then kind of backtrack over the course of a week to a much more nuanced position that may not convince people in the long run, is really evidence of just how difficult of a path it's going to be for him with that last name.
Well, also announcing this week, a man never shy about sharing his last name, Donald Trump, jumped into the race yesterday. He's teased this idea repeatedly in past elections, really doing it this time. He's got this celebrity recognition outside of the political world. Is this a publicity stunt, or is he really campaigning?
I think it's probably both, that he actually is campaigning. I mean, he has taken steps towards having an actual campaign in the past, even when he's just teased, and that he spent some of his own money on it. That's what he's doing right now. He actually has operations on the ground in Iowa and New Hampshire, maybe more than some of the candidates who we would assess as more credible candidates. Nonetheless, he is Donald Trump, so it's tough to really take him seriously, and that's going to be his challenge if he does want to be a viable candidate, and not just to have this as a publicity stunt. That said, even if it's just a publicity stunt, he does have the potential to impact the race because he has such high name identification, which has put him in the top 10 in polls, the critical top 10 that is going to be necessary to get into some of the debates in this sprawling field. And he has the money to be able to foot the bill out of his own pocket to get around and do the things that are necessary to meet voters and to continue to register in those polls. And because, as you alluded to, he is a bomb thrower, he is outrageous, he is something of a provocateur, he is going to force some of these other candidates to respond to them. So far, they've tried to laugh it off. In some cases, literally, Jeb Bush actually barely suppressed a laugh when he was asked yesterday about Donald Trump's entry into the race. But I think eventually when you get up there on the debate stage with a Donald Trump and he pushes you on a policy like immigration, where he has a real sort of drastic plan to build a gigantic wall between the U.S. and Mexico and have the Mexicans pay for it, like, good luck with that. But something outrageous like that at a debate is gonna sort of compel some of the other candidates to get into their own plans and maybe even drag them to the right or force them to propose something equally bold.
Talking national politics with Ken Vogel from Politico. Let's turn for the presidential race to Congress. A lot going on there. A setback for this proposed Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement supported by the president and many Republicans fell short last week. Pro-trade Democrats are trying to bring it back. Do they have a chance? Will we see this come back to votes?
Potentially. I mean, the GOP is really driving the bus on this. And they have devised a sort of plan B to overcome some of the Democratic opposition, and their current plan is to sort of separate the fast-track bill, known as the Trade Promotion Authority, from the Trade Adjustment Assistance. That's the worker aid package that Democrats had voted down to try to derail the whole package. It's sort of unclear with the White House is, you know, where the White House stands on this, but President Obama is holding meetings at the White House today with key House and Senate Democrats who are trying to decide whether they are going to go along with Obama, potentially, you know, in some sort of compromise with Republican leadership that would really buck the Democratic Party leadership and create a real rift that is also has 2016 implications, and that it really plays into this idea that it's hot in the Democratic base, that there needs to be whether it's protectionism or otherwise, there needs to be some domestic and some combination of domestic and international trade policies that help bridge the gap between the haves and the have-nots. This idea that you hear about rising income inequality, Hillary Clinton has, as a result, sort of been put on the spot on this debate on this bill and has not really come up with a very clear answer about whether she supports it. She said she wants to see what's in the final package, and as I just discussed, it's going to be potentially a little ways before we have some sense as to what the final package, if there is a final package, for sort of a reboot of this effort.
Well, also in Congress today, Republican leadership briefing lawmakers about their plan in case the King versus Burwell Supreme Court decision takes away health care subsidies for Americans, at least 34 states. This is all under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. So this is a big deal. If these subsidies are lifted, what do we know about what Republicans are thinking to do in reaction to that?
Well, there have been some meetings between the on the Senate side of Senate Republicans to try to craft a plan. You know, this is a little bit of careful what you wish for. Obviously, Republicans in 2014 and 2012 campaigned and 2010 campaigned on getting rid of Obamacare and how terrible it was. But now, of course, it's been in effect for some time and it's had a chance to sort of demonstrate its benefits to people. If this decision ends up in repealing some or all of some of these programs, it could erase health insurance subsidies for people in at least 34 states, a majority of which are red states. So it kind of puts Republicans even more in a bind. One of the things that they're talking about is a temporary assistance program that would be provided to people who are losing those subsidies. It's not really clear what that would look like, how much assistance it would provide or how long it would provide it for. Senate Republican leadership supports a plan from Senator Ron Johnson right there in Wisconsin to extend the subsidies through 2017 while repealing the law's requirements to have health insurance, to have an offer insurance. The 2017 date there is notable, of course, because it would put off sort of a final resolution until after the 2016 general election.
Well, we'll be watching for that Supreme Court decision. I'm sure you will too, Ken. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
That's Ken Vogel, chief investigative correspondent at Politico, talking about the latest in national politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. In American culture, being a go-getter is something that's generally praised and encouraged. We hear sayings like, the early bird gets the worm, or you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Well, what's it like to actually be the go-getter in any given situation? New research shows that employees who are seen as more competent, those go-getters, the people who get things done, well, they get assigned more work, and they're not necessarily happy about that.
Here to talk about this new research is one of the lead authors, Christy Jo Koval. She is a PhD student in the management department at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. Christy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So to get our terminology straight, when we use the word go-getter or more competent people, who are we talking about?
So in our research, we're specifically looking at people with high self-control. Self-control, or what we commonly refer to as willpower, is what allows us to override our immediate desires and to replace them with behaviors that are more in line with our long-term goals. So, for example, it enables us to quit smoking in order to stay healthy, and it gets us to study for an exam on a Friday night instead of going out with our friends. As social psychologists, we have studied self-control for quite some time and have found that having high self-control is a really good thing. People with high self-control tend to have better grades at school, they have better physical and mental health, and overall just have more satisfying relationships.
So at the workplace, does that translate into they're better at getting things done?
Definitely. In our operationalization of go-getter, we're really looking at these competent employees, and that's part of it.
And how did you find out that people assign more work to people that they perceive as more competent, or these people with greater self-control, these people we're calling go-getters?
Right. So to test for this, we did a lab study with undergrad students. We asked them to assign a series of essay proofreading tasks to these student volunteers, and then we got them to read the profiles of these volunteers. We then manipulated how much self-control each of the volunteers had by having them answer a question about their New Year's resolution and whether they were able to stick to that. So, for example, one of the students said their goal was to save money, but they ended up spending their savings, so they didn't actually save any money. But for another student, their goal was to, for example, have better dental hygiene by flossing every night, and they were able to floss pretty much every night, and therefore, you know, achieving that New Year's resolution. And we found that participants assigned more proofreading tasks to the student volunteers who demonstrated willpower by being more successful at these goals than the student volunteers who were less successful.
And then the thinking there is this might play out in the workplace. If we perceive a coworker as having that self-control, the potential to get things done, we might say, yeah, I want them doing the task. Or if I'm a manager in particular, I might say, I want that person doing this important task, maybe more work than those other slackers.
Yes, that's definitely right.
And how do these people feel about it? I mean, if you're the go-getter, in a way, it can be nice to be singled out from the herd for an assignment, but there can be a downside.
Yeah, definitely. So, like you just mentioned, it's good to feel trusted and respected by others, you know, feel honored to be given this work. But we do think that in our research, at least, we found that people, there are also some downside to being assigned this extra work. Specifically, we found that people were given the more work ended up feeling more tired than those who were being assigned less work. And this increased workload also had a negative effect on how they thought about their work and those people who gave them the work. And consequently, they actually felt more burdened by this increased responsibility, as we called it.
We're talking to Christy Jo Koval. She's a PhD student in management at Duke University, looking at effective people at the workplace and how they may be assigned more work by their peers, by their managers, and may not be happy about that in the short and long run. And Christy, following up on that point you just made, you did more experiments, I think, looking at the perceptions of how much work someone is doing. The person, that go-getter, we're calling him, the person with self-control who gets more work and is feeling that they're doing more work, but everybody else may not get how much of an impact that has. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So in one study, we found that people actually underestimated how much it would take for the go-getters to get their job done. So in other words, not only they assign them with more work, but they also think, oh, it's not that effortful, or they don't have to spend as much time or effort to for these go-getters to get the work done. And in terms of how it makes them feel at work, I think one implication is that, you know, if people don't think it's hard for the go-getters to get the job done, then they probably won't think to reward them for the extra work they're doing. So, for example, a manager might give their star employee the same bonus as all the other employees, despite the fact that they've done more work. And we think that from the go-getter's perspective, this probably created a feeling that they're being unfairly treated, and they might end up feeling annoyed in general just about this work arrangement. They're probably thinking, why should I do more work for the same reward when my less capable coworkers can just coast along with less work?
Isn't pay often tied to performance, though? So if people are doing the extra work, that they might be singled out for better pay.
That's definitely possible, but I think a lot of these sort of more subtle things, for example, maybe you want to ask your go-getter workers, high competent workers, to organize the company retreat or these sort of other lower quality but more time consuming work just because you think they do well and they perform better. And that actually takes time and resources away for these go-getters to get their actual real important work done, which are really the ones that translate into, you know, performance and therefore the rewards that are tied to that. So by taking resources away for them to do those actually tasks, they don't get rewarded for those important things.
And Christy, I understand in addition to the lab experiments you just mentioned, you also surveyed people, employees out in the real world. What kind of things did you learn from those surveys?
Sure. So the high self-control employees we surveyed reported feeling more relied on by their bosses and coworkers, and they also felt more burdened as a result of this. As an important part of this study, though, we also surveyed these go-getters' colleagues and found that these colleagues didn't expect that. So these bosses and coworkers, they, even though they recognized the extra work that the go-getters were doing, but they actually didn't predict that it would be a burden for them. So we think that this disconnect in, you know, how we see ourselves and how others see us can actually create problems in our relationships, both at work and at home.
Let's talk about that at home part for a little bit, because it seems like this is applicable to our relationships. If one partner is better at doing something like handling the finances, I don't know, taking out the garbage, they generally pick those things up and they might not get all the credit that they're due.
Yeah, for sure. You know, in our personal lives, our high self-control spouses might take on more and more of the domestic responsibilities over time. And like you just mentioned, these extra work might not go, they might go unnoticed by their partners, and who might just assume that they can handle it and even thrive on it. And in fact, in one of our studies, we surveyed over 100 couples who are in romantic relationships. We measured how much self-control each person had and asked them, you know, how much they felt relied on by their partner, whether they felt tired by being relied on, and how satisfied they were with their relationship. And what we found was that high self-control individuals compared to individuals with low self-control felt that they were more relied on by their partner, and they felt more tired by others relying on them. And this, in turn, actually led them to feel less satisfied about their relationship.
Well, on any of these surveys or studies in relationships or workplaces, was there an upside here for that high self-control person, the person who gets things done, thinking, yeah, I'm doing more work, but hey, people count on me. I'm glad that I'm contributing. Did you get any kind of positive response like that?
Yes, definitely. And that is actually one point I like to clear, is that even though we're sort of, you know, demonstrating these interpersonal costs for high self-control people, but in general, it is the people with high self-control, these go-getters, that reap the reward. You know, they are more satisfied with their relationships. And even, for example, within the study I just told you about with romantic relationship couples, it's still the high self-control people that had overall better, higher quality relationship with their partners. But it's just that there's this sort of, you know, indirect effect of feeling a little bit tired and burdened by others.
So people do feel tired and burdened by others. Maybe that people don't know all the work that they're putting into something. What should they do about it? How can they correct that?
Right. So first of all, I think it's important for us to just recognize this bias that we have, you know, to recognize how much we are depending on people who are capable, and that there it is causing a burden, that this is a burden that we're placing on them. In a workplace, we think that managers should be careful to select and give the highest quality work and best opportunities to the most capable employees, instead of just dumping everything, you know, like the lower quality time-consuming work on them, like the company retreat sort of I just talking about. I think another thing, though, is that managers should reward their employees appropriately. And this is something we've also touched on earlier. If someone is doing more than his fair share, compensate him for it. If not, he might ultimately leave and seek recognition elsewhere.
Christy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Christy Jo Koval, PhD student at Duke University. She was with us to talk about new research about how people with high levels of self-control, people conceived of as go-getters, often get more work.
Coming up, we want to hear from you on all this at 800-642-1234. Are you the go-getter? Are you the competent coworker? Do you feel like, as a consequence, you get more of the work assigned to you? How do you feel about that? Do you like it? You like doing all the stuff? Or do you feel overwhelmed, tired, taken advantage of? Or are you a workplace slacker? You're glad these people are around to pick up the slack that you leave. If you're a manager, how do you sort all this out? Have you thought about this before? And in a personal relationship, romantic relationship, marriage, say, is there this divide in your relationship? One of you does all the stuff and maybe doesn't get recognized for it. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're asking you what it's like to be a go-getter. New research shows that people who are more competent are assigned more work and are relied on more at home, too. The research also shows that people usually underestimate how much work it takes for the go-getters to get these extra tasks done. And according to what the researchers found, the go-getters, they're not liking it much.
And we're looking to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does the story from this research match your reality? Are you relied on more at home or at work because you're more disciplined? You're better at getting things done. Are you unhappy with that? Do you feel like you're a sucker getting taken advantage of by your slacker coworkers or spouse? How does your workplace treat the go-getters versus everybody else? Is it fair? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. I've got Michael on the line in Pilot Mom, Minnesota. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Good.
Are you a go-getter?
Yeah, I guess so. I've been in an arts apprentice program for 2 years, and I'm now the lead apprentice of it as to where there's another apprentice below me. And I think it kind of comes down to, I guess naturally some people are born with probably a little bit more ambition and energy than others, or just how, you know, excited you are about the work that you're doing. And if you're really excited about the work that you're doing, if you're really ambitious about it, you're going to take on more course workload or more workload because it's kind of what you want to do as compared to someone else who may not want to be there as much. And if, you know, if that gives me more responsibility, if that makes me work harder or have to because I'm, you know, expected to because they've seen it before, I'm okay with that. You know, I'm okay with working harder than somebody else with the same pay or compensation.
Gotcha. So if you're motivated, you don't mind working a little bit more because it's what you want to be doing in the first place.
Exactly. I don't think there's a problem with that at all. I mean, there's people below me who, you know, do work hard, but not as hard as I do. But it, I think, falls a lot on how invested you are in whatever you do. And if you're invested in it, then I think you're totally, it's okay.
Thanks a lot for that, Michael. Appreciate your thoughts.
Interesting. We'll go now to Gail in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. I think overachiever is my middle name. It's always been. And eventually, I finally decided I quit and went into my own business. And the gentleman that I'm with, my significant other, had done the same thing in his line of work, too. So we have our own businesses, and I'm a consultant, and he owns an international firm. So all of our extra overachievingness, it goes into our own piggy bank. And we are our own boss.
That's interesting, Gail. I want to ask, Gail, before you went into your own business, before you became a consultant, did you feel like as the office overachiever, they just kept dumping more and more work on you?
Oh, yeah, they did. And they would eat up deadline time. And I got to where I had to start to delegate up and report directly to the top guy so that I could make sure that I had control of all of my workflow. And then I would have power behind me in order to get things done without hidden agendas getting in the way of all these other people. Because I had to work with 105 people.
Oh, okay. Well, Gail, thanks a lot for calling. And I think, this might be a case where going it alone, going into your own business, makes a lot of sense. Then you're dumping work
on
yourself.
You're overachieving for yourself. Yeah, that makes some sense. Thanks, Gail. We're going to go next to Ed. Ed's calling from Paddock Lake. Hi there.
Hi. Well, I was going to go there because I still am, but... previous job, boy, did I paint myself into a corner. All of a sudden, I was the go-to person. And it kept coming and coming. And even though I tried to talk to the boss, say, look, this has gone on too far, didn't change. So I got another job.
All right. So it sounds like that's one of the things that can happen with these go-getters. They burn out. They go somewhere else where they're not going to be as put upon, and that's exactly what Ed did. Thanks for your thoughts.
Yeah, that's what we're hearing from the researcher, Christy, who her one take-home for managers was, watch these people, don't overload them. You're going to lose your best people that way. Interesting. We are talking about being the office, the workplace, or maybe the relationship go-getter, the one who gets things done, and whether if you're that person, you get too much dumped on you. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Matthew is with us next in Kenosha. Matthew, hi there.
Hey, I love the show, guys.
Thanks. What do you think?
I think my boss is a go-getter, and he does a fantastic job, and he sets a very high standard, a very high bar. But his boss, which is actually the owner of the company, I can see how he gets a lot of stuff dumped on him, and he tries very, very, very hard. So even though he's really good with me and I love to be the go-getter for him, he's the go-getter for his boss, and I see a lot of unfairness, I guess, but it does set a high standard, and that's what I enjoy.
And Matthew, despite what's happening maybe at the very top, you feel like this is a good kind of leadership for you if your direct boss is a go-getter you're going to follow.
I'm absolutely going to follow him. In fact, sometimes he needs somebody just to help him out, and I'm more than happy to step up and help him out because he would do it for me even though he's my direct superior. So.
Interesting. Matthew, thanks a lot for that perspective, the go-getter as the boss in that situation.
And next we go to Marnie joining us in Brookfield. Hi, Marnie.
Hi. This seems to be happening to both my daughters, one with an MBA and the other one with her degree. And the problem would be the one would finish up everything she needed to be doing by 2 o'clock or something in the afternoon. And instead, then they'd start just dumping more on her and not, you know, that other people weren't finishing. And with the second daughter, it happened and is happening. And in a previous situation, not only would she get dumped on like that, but then because this weak-kneed manager didn't want to deal with this other person that was slacking off, he decided that they should all work in pairs. And, of course, you know what he did. He paired up the slacker with my daughter.
That sounds like your classic example there. We're talking about the someone who gets their work done sooner, they get more work. Well, thank you for sharing that experience of your daughter's, Marnie.
And time for a quick call from Scott in Madison. Scott, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I was going to call and just tell you about, I mean, I'm a teacher, so the go-getting thing has always been like an asset. But in relationships, it's not always been that way. So, like, in my family relationships, I'm a go-getter. I was always proud of it. But a lot of times, things got piled on me, and I got taken advantage of eventually. And it actually kind of hurt my family relationships as well as my friend relationships. Because, you know, I do like to be there. I do like to help out. But I don't want people not to be as vested or as energetic about the relationship as I am.
Interesting.
And so if I get taken advantage of it, just kind of, you know, it kind of hurts me eventually.
Great. Thanks for sharing that personal perspective, Scott. Thanks for all of your calls and comments. And you can keep this conversation going over at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. There's been a whole lot of buzz about this Jurassic World movie setting records this weekend, latest in the Jurassic Park film franchise. One thing that's gotten people talking isn't just the dinos. It's trying to figure out why the movie's heroine, Claire, I guess her name is, I haven't seen it yet, but I guess she's running away from dinosaurs the whole time wearing high heels.
And I guess we have to suspend disbelief. Claire would probably not know ahead of time that she's going to be running from rampaging dinosaurs. She's a corporate executive. But still, that's pretty much the height of an impractical footwear choice when there are so many comfortable and attractive options for shoes. Why are you going to be wearing high heels at a dino park?
Right.
I have to ask.
People are saying it's a far cry from that Laura Dern character in the earlier movies. She was sticking her arm into the pile of dino droppings. Very practical.
In hiking boots.
In hiking boots, right. So New York Times columnist Gretchen Reynolds, we've had her on the show before, she picked up on this and took a look at the science behind wearing high heels. Guess what? Probably better not to wear high heels in the long run, period, and definitely bad to run in high heels, even in a low dinosaur environment. Just generally bad for you to try to do stuff in high heels.
Although if there is a dinosaur and you're wearing high heels, it's probably still better to run.
Yeah, or you could like lob the pointy end of the high heels at the dinosaur. I mean, they've got thick hides. I don't know what that does. I could not imagine in my life wearing high heels for that practical reason. It just doesn't
you might be running from dinosaurs?
Well, no. Even without the dinosaurs, even just on a daily walk, you know, with tigers or modern predators.
Gotta get used to it. But we've got that piece by Gretchen Reynolds up on the Facebook page if you want to take a look and reassess your footwear choices.
More to come here on Central Time.